On this week's 51%, we learn about using photos and storytelling to help sexual assault survivors. We hear from a social worker by day, singer by night.
I pictured my life completely different. I thought that I would, you know, make singing my career because I didn't want to be a social worker when I was 18. That's not what I was thinking.
And we hear from a singer-songwriter who's on tour with her 7th album. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
You know this isn't the end. No longer silent.
One out of every 6 American women has experienced a sexual assault or an attempted sexual assault or rape in her lifetime. That's according to the National Institute of Justice and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. While more than one half of female survivors of rape report symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, previous research has found that not all survivors respond to traditional treatments for PTSD, and their symptoms resurface over time. Dr. Abigail Rolbecki, a researcher at the University of Missouri School of Medicine, says that photo voice interventions, where participants express their thoughts and feelings through photos combined with traditional PTSD treatments, could result in a more complete recovery for survivors of sexual assault. Rolbecki's study, Waiting for the Cold to End, Using Photo Voice as a Narrative Intervention for Survivors of Sexual Assault, was published in Traumatology, an international journal for health professionals who study and treat people exposed to highly stressful and traumatic events. I spoke with Rolbecki about why she undertook the study of 9 women.
I, as a graduate student, worked for the university's Relationship and Sexual Violence Prevention Center, which is an office on our campus that provides, you know, some crisis intervention and case management to survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and stalking. And I kind of started in that world or in that space doing prevention work. And as I progressed in my clinical social work program, I started to do more of the crisis intervention. And as part of my field placement, I was doing more clinically, driven intervention work with survivors of sexual assault specifically. And that kind of overlapped with what I was doing in my dissertation, which is actually the study that you're referencing, the use of photo voice as a therapeutic tool for survivors of sexual assault. But kind of as a second, field of education and work, I have an educational degree in public health, a Master of Public Health degree, and I learned of photo voice in that experience. And I used photo voice in its true form as a participatory action research method across several different populations and health issues. And within each of those studies, the participants cited their experience of sharing their stories through photo voice with other people who had this kind of common understanding of what's going on, incredibly therapeutic. And I was like, man, we really should be looking at this as an intervention for survivors of sexual assault, because it really embodies some of the gold standard intervention components that people typically use when treating post-traumatic stress disorder in traumatized or people who've experienced trauma. And that's cognitive and behavioral elements. And by cognitive, what I mean is that, you know, survivors are reframing their negative thoughts. In the world of photo voice, in a collective storytelling process, they're talking about their experiences together and the negative thoughts of self-blame that they may have. They're kind of working through that as a group and realizing that, it's not their fault and that society chooses to blame them. And what they're doing is really kind of reclaiming that and saying, no, that's not the case. And then the behavioral element is the exposure piece. And so in photo voice, in this study particularly, survivors are were given cameras, and they went into their world and they documented their lives and their experiences of survivorship on the university's campus. And with that came a lot of exposure to triggers, which, you know, people who work in trauma know that exposing yourself to triggers is actually a good thing. Typically, when people think of that, and when I tell people, they're like, no, they think, you know, oh, well, if you're scared of, like, spiders, why would you, you know, put a bunch of spiders in front of somebody? Actually, it's a helpful tool. It helps desensitize you to the, I guess, trigger and the emotional reactions that are associated with that trigger. And over time, repeated exposure desensitizes you and you're able to kind of function and within kind of that triggered environment. And so survivors, which I thought was incredibly brave, some of them went to the very site of their experience and photographed that picture, and then they repeatedly exposed themselves to those triggers and kind of bringing up those emotional reactions in the collective storytelling process when they were discussing their pictures as a group.
Were the women all college age?
Yes. So this is a pilot. It was a, you know, kind of a feasibility study, and we were just wanting to see how this intervention would work. And so their experiences weren't all at the university. Some of them had experiences early on in life. Some of them had multiple experiences. The majority did experience sexual assault while at the university.
So are you saying that the result of this work is not one therapy can be deemed the most effective, but a combination of therapies is best? And I'm sure that depends greatly on the individual.
Yeah, it is definitely a combination, but I do just kind of want to back up and say that every person's experience is unique and how they react to their experience is unique. You know, the women, they all had kind of this shared experience of sexual assault, but they are very unique. And not every person who experiences that kind of a trauma will have post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, the women in the study were, you know, I can't give any clinical diagnosis, but they did have presentation of symptoms associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. And so that was kind of one of the criteria for entering the study. As far as the added support to the evidence base or the interventions that are used today, I do want to just note that they are very effective. Prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, trauma-informed cognitive behavioral therapy, those are all things that are very well researched and have been proven successful at helping survivors kind of return to baseline and be resilient in, you know, the face of their trauma. But what I'm suggesting is that we need to go beyond that kind of notion of return to baseline. And what I'm suggesting is that survivors need to kind of have a space and the opportunity to foster post-traumatic growth and make meaning of their experiences to kind of, you know, not just return to baseline, but ultimately grow and heal. And what I'm suggesting is that photo voice, specifically the kind of storytelling element within photo voice, is what's helping the survivors of this study do that.
You know, it's interesting. I feel like I'm seeing a lot more storytelling being mentioned as a therapy, be it for veterans, be it for troubled youth, just as a kind of an alternative therapy. And I wonder if as a society, we're becoming more accepting of alternative therapies in addition to the doctor victim, doctor patient paradigm.
Yeah. So in, you know, sexual assault specifically, like I was saying earlier, society plays a huge role in kind of the narrative around, you know, how a survivor should heal and really their experience in general. Their perpetrator and society kind of authors that narrative. And what I'm suggesting is that either, you know, through the use of photo voice or some other type of, you know, storytelling element, survivors can reauthor that and enter back into the world with this reclaimed self-narrative that they've solely authored themselves. And in this particular study, they did have the opportunity to do that. They, you know, met together and they discussed their photos collectively in a group, and then they presented their photos in exhibit where they invited stakeholders to come bear witness to these stories. And that was their opportunity to kind of enter back into society, you know, with this self-narrative. This is how I heal. This is where I'm going from, you know, this point on. This is how I've made meaning of my experience, et cetera. And they did that, and then they did it again. They presented the photos to a public exhibit where they invited students and other just general campus affiliates to come bear witness to their stories. And that process is incredibly healing.
So where do you go from here? Do you see this study having a wider application? Kind of what's next?
Yeah, so I do see it having a wider application. While I've spent a significant amount of my clinical time and my you know, research time devoted to the issue of sexual assault. And, you know, I'm a scholar. And so I have all these identities, but I really consider myself a storyteller because at the heart of the work that I do are these incredibly profound stories, not just for survivors, but I'm working on a study now that's using a very similar intervention approach, but with patients living with chronic pain. I'm doing digital storytelling with families who are bereaved, who've lost children, as a way to kind of heal as a family intervention. And, you know, I will plan to use these storytelling elements and digital media throughout my work, I guess, until I'm done.
I bet it was very fulfilling to bear witness to these women empowering themselves and creating their own narratives, reclaiming their narratives, as you said before.
Yeah, it was. It's interesting because, you know, a lot of people have asked if I plan to continue doing work in sexual assault. And I do, you know, I will always remain dedicated to that work in that field. But there was something that shifted when I finished that project for me. And I don't know, I can't really put my finger on it and I can't really describe it. But the experience I had was so profound, and I'm incredibly privileged to have had the opportunity to kind of witness what happened as a group for them. You know, it's just, you know, their stories forever changed me, and it, I don't know, I just, it's going to be something that I will always remember.
That's great. Were any of the women friends before this, or are they friends now?
They are friends now, and nobody knew each other coming into this. So there are some who still remain in contact with each other today. There are some who remain in contact with me.
So there are some lasting connections from this, it seems, and it's nice because you can pick up the phone, shoot an email. There's something there.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Whenever at the end of the study, I asked them, each of them, what the most meaningful piece of the intervention, and I would say almost every single one of them said meeting the other women because they felt that they were alone in their healing.
That was Dr. Abigail Rolbecky, a researcher at the University of Missouri School of Medicine, talking about her study, Waiting for the Cold to End, using photo voice as a narrative intervention for survivors of sexual assault. We've all heard the advice, follow your passion. But what happens when the realities of finances and family get in the way? In Fall River, Massachusetts, Barbara Paulson meets Katarina Avalar, whose story answers a question many creative people face. What do dreams look like in real life?
On any given day, you'll find Katarina Avalar visiting families for her job as a social worker.
So this is a really, really tough area here.
Most of them live in Fall River's housing projects.
It's three rows of these big brick buildings, and they probably...
Katarina places children in foster homes when their parents can no longer care for them.
The drug issue that we have in the city is just absolutely horrific, and it is just swallowing, like, everyone. It's really
her job is stressful, but she's devoted to it.
I love my work. I love making a change in people's lives. I love the kids that I work with, and they need us.
So you might think social work is Katarina's main passion, but her first love? Katarina sings a style of Portuguese music known for its tragic lyrics and haunting melodies. It's called fado, and it's infused with something the Portuguese call saudade.
It's a longing or a yearning for something, either a lost love or a lost friend or a lost relationship. And I feel like a lot of people associate the word saudade with fado because a lot of the people in our area, anyway, they're immigrants, so they feel that longing for, like, their homeland.
Katarina grew up singing hymns at her Portuguese church. At 16, she won a talent contest at the local radio station. The summer after high school, she was invited to Portugal to perform at concerts around the country. One night, she sang before an audience of thousands.
And I remember the music starting and everybody kind of like all the clapping and the cheering. And at the end of that, people were going crazy. I said to myself, I want to do this for the rest of my life.
But when summer came to an end, the voice in her head changed its tune.
There's no real job security in that. Musicians in Portugal, they do it, but, you know, they struggle.
Katarina was a dreamer, but she also wanted to live in the real world. So she came home, and her life got complicated. She became a social worker. She got married, divorced, and remarried. And she continued to sing, but on the side.
Okay, wonderful. Okay.
Tonight, Katerina is rehearsing for an upcoming fado show. She performs 2 to 3 times a month at local clubs.
This dia de não me lembro em que dia de setembro.
So it's a woman and she's talking about how, you know, you and I parted ways in September.
A rua estava deserta.
It was the evening. The roads were empty.
The song conjures memories of her first marriage.
And there are some fado songs, I think, that it was almost like they were written for me because they almost retell my story.
Other songs remind her of the troubled kids she tries to help every day.
I try to, when I go home at 5, say, you know, this is for work and I'll deal with it tomorrow. But it's really hard because we're dealing with human beings. We're dealing with other people.
Katerina's life has not turned out the way she imagined.
I pictured my life completely different. I thought that I would, you know, make singing my career because I didn't want to be a social worker when I was 18. That's not what I was thinking.
But she says her life is richer for the twists and turns it's taken.
Because now, you know, I get to do what I love to do for work and I get to still sing.
And there's a benefit to living that double life, one she didn't see coming, because early on, she felt she hadn't lived enough to sing fado.
I didn't think I really had experienced any of life's tragedies, so I wouldn't dare sing fado.
And now, well, you can hear for yourself.
Começo a ver que não esqueço.
If there's a day where I've been sad or I've been like emotional at work and I have a performance that night, I sing better, especially some of those songs, like I said, like I feel were made for me. I feel like I can interpret those differently now, maybe with more sentiment than I could before.
Até que me encontrei.
Katerina is comfortable with the choices she's made.
You know, some bumps, some lost loves, right? That I sing about so often, but I'm okay. I'm okay.
Mas foste o grande amor da minha vida.
For WCAI's Creative Life, I'm Barbara Paulson in Fall River.
You might know singer-songwriter Regina Spektor for You've Got Time, the theme song for the TV series Orange is the New Black. Now she's touring her 7th album. The 4 years between Spektor's 2012 album, What We Saw from the Cheap Seats, and the new Remember Us to Life, was spent taking care of a couple of major events, a new marriage and then in 2014, the birth of her first child. So there are some bigger themes on her mind, including parenthood, love, and time. It was that last theme that she spoke about with Speed of Sound's Kyle Meredith.
His destiny was just too big to spend, so he broke it into smaller bills and change. By the time he tried to buy the things he needed, he had spent it all on Lucy's and weed.
I feel like I've been concerned with time passing since I was a child already. I think that even when I was little, I was really worried about growing up and forgetting something very important. And I remember connecting to certain writers or books that kind of centered on that, like even a book like The Little Prince, you know, talks about how there's this knowledge that a child has that you kind of lose, and I don't know, I always kind of felt like even when I was little, I was kind of this old person who was like, looking back at my life, it's this strange headspace to just be so aware of time.
The trapper and the furrier went walking through paradise, and all the animals lay clawless and toothless before them.
I know part of the hook of this story that also you're talking a lot about is you know, being a parent as you're writing all of this, and you know, hearing some songs on this record. I mean, I'm sure you are a great storyteller at nighttime because of these things.
Well. Yeah, my kid thinks that the entire world is a musical. He probably thinks that everybody just bursts in song and dance every 5 minutes for no apparent reason. But you definitely get shaken up and kind of reconfigured in some way as soon as you have a kid. I felt it. Like I felt the most kind of vulnerable in some way, because all of a sudden there's this There's this being that you love so much, and it hurts so much to not be in control and to not be able to just say everything will forever be okay and I could fix everything. I could fix the world. I could fix the climate. I could fix all things that are going on, because you look at this person's face and you think you deserve for everything to be great always, you know? And there's a pain that comes with that.
Someday you'll grow up and then you'll forget all of the pain you endured, until you walk by a sad pair of eyes and up will come back all the hurt.
But at the same time, I was listening to the show once and they were talking about how the only way for humans to create more of a sense of time, more of a length of time in their lifespan, is to feel the feeling of awe. That's really the thing that kind of creates this. So if you go through a regular day, it kind of goes by in a certain amount of time. But if you go and you hike to the top of a mountain and you look over this incredible vista, that day actually feels longer. And by the time your life ends, if you have had a lot of these moments of awe, whether they're in seeing art or in being with loved ones or being just in awe of beauty and humanity and nature, you kind of in the same amount of time have had maybe more time than if you were just kind of going through the same routine.
But I also heard that is what a lot of these songs are. That's sort of the difference between these songs and your other ones, that they are a bit more present tense.
I feel like the thing that I really want, like if I was to wish something to my songs on their birthday, mm-hmm. The songs that I love the most, they kind of suspend time for me. Like I feel like when I'm listening to a song, a new song I'd never heard or a song that I love, you know, I feel like it's almost like I get to go on this trip and it's such a complete world. And then when the song ends, I come back and I just realize that, you know, maybe that 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, it really felt like a lot bigger mm-hmm. than what it was. And so that's what I wish for them to be, like little trips mm-hmm. that people could take. And they can go to these places and they could just go into it. It's not virtual reality, but it's kind of like a like that. I love when you get to kind of complete things and collaborate, like as a listener or as a reader. You're not fully locked in, you know, into like a roller coaster where like everything is, all your senses are kind of engaged. So like when you're listening to radio or you're listening to music or you're reading a book, there's always something that's just free to wander. I like when your imagination can still be off doing something and your mind's eye can be seeing something while your ears are listening.
Regina Spektor's Remember Us to Life is one of the best albums you could get for yourself right now. Top recommendation. For more of my interviews, head to Facebook and Twitter at Kyle Meredith. And thanks to Brad Yost for co-producing and editing this episode. And from the studios of WFPK in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Kyle Meredith at the Speed of Sound.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1436.